Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. I'm Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel.
Hello, Fiona.
Hi, Gail. How has your writing week been?
You will remember that last week I had finished this process of going through my book, writing down what I liked, writing what I didn't like, and moving on. And now I've done the moving on. And what has been really interesting about it is I have followed my own advice about moving on. And the two things that I always tell people, write a realistic amount a day, and we know that for me it's 500 words, and stop in the flow. And I've been following that strictly, and it's been working. And I've realized that actually, listeners, I hope you're listening, I give very good advice. And both those things are so important. I'm not allowing any excuse to get in the way of me and my 500 words. I get them done, whatever the cost is to my sanity. And I don't let myself go. I think I've let myself go up to 700 one day. But then stop in the flow, because then you can come back the next day and you still have ideas and you still have excitement. So it's working for me. I've had a very good writing week.
I think we actually need to remember that you and I give very good advice that we don't always follow. And when we are following our own advice, we have a great writing week. And when we've fallen off the wagon and we're not following our own advice, then things don't feel so great.
And I think also that we have the danger of getting too complicated about it, thinking that there's some answer when actually we know our own processes, we know what works for us, and you just have to keep on showing up and doing. And that is the only way. I'm always telling people the only way a book gets written is if you sit down and write it. So I'm sitting down and writing this book.
Fantastic.
Fiona, what are you sitting down and writing this week?
I'm struggling a bit with the difficulty that I'm having, and I think I've touched on it before. I am reviewing a manuscript and revising it. And I spoke last week about how I'm dealing with this difficult issue of a character discovering their sexuality. And I find that everything I cut in the manuscript is fine. I don't miss it. It's gone, never needed to be there. But everything I add in, when I then go back and read that whole chapter, the thing that I added in seems to stand out to me like a sore thumb. And I don't know, is it just because I know it's new, or is it actually a bit jarring? And it's difficult to get distance from that.
It's so interesting, because I find it very hard to add in. I always say to myself, I'll go back and add in, but I find that I segue quite tightly. And it's really hard to get another scene, because the one scene leads to the other scene in my mind very smoothly. So I do struggle with that. I would guess that most likely it's only you seeing it.
Yes, because I'm the only one who knew that that part was never there before.
Yeah.
And that this is my attempt to fix that big glaring problem that was there.
Yeah, maybe you need to get another pair of eyes on it and see. But it's a difficult one, though, because I really struggle with adding in.
Yeah. Well, if I come up with any great solution to that problem, I will let everybody know.
Please, because I suspect this is going to be facing me in the future soon.
And in the meantime, what have you been reading or watching or listening to?
So I have made a promise to myself that I'm going to stop reading crap books because they're there. And I'm going to make a conscious effort to read books that I know I will enjoy. So I don't mean intellectually showy, offy books. I'm not going to go and read the Booker Prize shortlist. I'm really not. But books that I know from other people's reviews that I will enjoy. And one of the books that I have read recently that falls into that category is Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. Now, this is a book that I thought I had read. It's got a cover that looks a lot like other covers at the moment. What happened is my friend Georgie asked me if I'd read it, and I said, I think so, but I can't remember it. And she was like, Gail, one of the narrators is an octopus. Not even you can have forgotten that. And I was like, no, I definitely haven't read a book where one of the narrators is an octopus. So I went and read it, and indeed I had definitely not read it. And it is just lovely. It is just so beautiful and lovely and easy to read. And really, if you haven't read it, one of the narrators is an octopus. And it just go and read it. It's so, so lovely. I believe they're making it into a movie. I can't imagine how the octopus narrator is going to work in the movie, but I look forward to seeing. What about you, Fiona? What have you been absorbing?
Well, I've been watching TV lately, and last month you talked about your rush to finish Killing Eve before it gets removed from our screens. And I have been rushing to finish this show because I wanted to watch it with my daughter, and she was due to go back to Stellenbosch, and we had a deadline. So we really, really binged this. And it is Severance, the show Severance that everyone's talking about. And, you know, I tried to watch the first episode before and it didn't quite click with it, but this time I was determined. And whether it was because I was more alert or whatever it was, I clicked instantly with this show.
Okay.
And it's a very high concept, almost dystopian kind of thing, a little bit speculative, fiction-y, which is not normally absolutely my happy place, but this is so absorbing and just draws on so many what feel like real world dilemmas. It's very much about your working world, the world of the office versus your real life world, not to give too much away. And it is so absorbing. It's so well done, so well directed, so beautifully shot that even if it sounds like it's not your thing, I can guarantee it's almost everyone's thing. And the only thing I regret is that I wish we'd started watching it once the whole thing was out. Because now, with these cliffhanger endings, to have to wait for the next season to be released is almost unbearable. It is so, so gripping. So if you don't mind that, start it now. But otherwise, wait until the whole thing's out and then binge it all in one go.
Yeah, and you've now given me a dilemma because I was thinking, oh, well, that can be my next watch. But with my memory, I don't like watching with the cliffhanger left open because then I don't know. By the time the next season comes, I've forgotten what the whole show was about. Although they do nice little recaps at the beginning of season, yes, so maybe I'll be up to it.
Well, an author whose sequel we are all anxiously awaiting is our guest today. Our guest today is Bonnie SP. Bonnie is the author of the book that everyone's talking about at the moment, Making a Killing, published by Quella Books, also by a piece of flash fiction in a collection called In Other Stories, which is published by Caravan Press. Bonnie, it's been a long time coming. We're very excited to talk to you. Hello and welcome.
Thank you so much. I've listened to all your podcasts, so I'm very excited to finally be in on one of them. So it's a huge honor. Thank you for the invitation.
And Bonnie, as a listener, you know where it starts. Tell us about your writing week.
I've actually been writing.
I like the surprise in your voice. Read,
yeah, the novel Making a Killing was launched in May, so it's been quite a busy time until now, where obviously there's, you know, festivals and podcasts and all sorts of things. But finally, I've actually got a bit of a gap, and I have a sense of urgency to write the sequel. So I'm having nice feedback from people. The book ends in a bit of a clangor, and they are saying, hey, when's the sequel coming? So I am writing, and I for the first time, I'm really urgently trying to write, trying to make time that I actually do sit and write and stop all the marketing that has to go around book one, you know, the Instagram and everything else that you're obliged to carry on with. So yes, I have been writing and happy with what I am writing. It's, I think my angst from launching book one is slightly, I won't say I'm relieved, but slightly got over that fear of, oh God, what will everyone think? Everyone's going to hate it. And I think I found a little niche and I'm trying to capitalize while my energies are still, my enthusiasm is still up there.
And what does that look like that you're writing every day? How many words? What time of day? Give us more insight into what that writing process looks like for you.
So I'm not like you, Gail. I don't do a word count. I don't lash myself if I didn't finish a word count. I literally just, the first thing I do is walk my dogs, Then I have a leisurely breakfast. I'm retired, so I don't have any other things in my way. And then I write. And sometimes, I don't know, 500 words, then I'm happy enough. I don't actually count the words. I have no idea how much I write. I just know, well, I've got something to say, while it's coming, I write it. And if it doesn't, I shut the computer and I go do something else. So perhaps I should have more of a structured writing life, but I don't. I literally do. Sometimes, mostly it's in the mornings, but I have been known to pour a glass of wine at about 4 o'clock, probably a little early for most, and write in the afternoons too. So it just depends.
And once you've had the wine, is the writing, does it make the quality better, worse, the same? What happens? Because I can't drink and write.
You know, they, yeah, you're advised not to, but I don't know. I think I'm quite good when I've had a glass of wine. That's my opinion of myself. I do, but I am a pedantic writer, so I will reread everything again before I start the next day. So I don't delete easily. I sort of, you know, all that work is how I feel. It's like, you know, using dirty, clean cups when you've just, you know, use the same dirty cup again rather than use clean cups because you're just going to have to wash them. So, yeah, so I do edit again. I'm unfortunately a very tedious, you know, I go back, reread, change the sentence, change a word, change, have a look at Facebook, have a look at, you know, Instagram. No, okay, let's get back to this. So I think I'm normal.
Yeah.
And before you start the new day's writing, do you go back and read what you wrote the previous day, or is it like paragraph by paragraph you're going back and reading and editing?
I do both. I definitely reread yesterday's work before I start again today, just to get myself back into the flow of what had been, what I have already covered.
Bonnie, you've just referred to the fact that you are retired, and we know that writing is not your first career by a long shot. Tell us a little bit about your origin story. What came before the writing?
So after matriculating, I went straight into a laboratory. So I have a technical background. I ended up my working career owning a company that used to import raw materials for the cosmetic industry. So I did that for 21 years. Finally sold that business and moved and retired. Moved to a small little village. I used to live in Johannesburg. Made big changes, you know. I mean, people thought I was mad, but it was the best thing I ever did, was moving away from Johannesburg to a tiny little village in the Western Cape.
But you did, through those years, write. When did that start? Was baby Bonnie a big writer? Well, maybe not baby Bonnie, child Bonnie. When did the writing dream start?
So I came, my entire family read a lot, except me. I didn't read. Oh. I used to, my dad would be reading, my mom would be reading, one older sister would be reading, and I'd say to them all, talk to me, because they were all busy, you know, and they'd all shut their books, look, put them down and look up, and then say, well, what do you want to talk about? Then, of course, there is no conversation. So I came from a reading family. We used to have to go to the library every week with my mom as a young teenager to change all the books. I used to walk down the aisle in the library and just look for Crime Club logo and pull out the Crime Club and take her book and say, here's one. You know, like, let's get out of the library now. This is boring stuff. So I think I was destined in the end to go this way, but I didn't read as a child, nor did I write. And the writing started when I used to run, long distance running. And one of the friends I used to run with used to say, what are you going to do when you can't run anymore? I need to teach you to crochet or knit or sew. And I knew none of those were me. And she said, yeah, well, you know, soon you'll be too old to run. And somewhere along the line, I saw I think it was the Random House writing course. Mm-hmm. I forget how long it was, 6-week course, online course. And that's where it started. I met got a community from that. One of the girls on that community I'm still friends with. So that's, I think, where it started. And yeah, I was never going to crochet. It's just not me.
Bonnie, I saw that you've said before that you've been writing for years in one form or another. What was that writing? Do you have a drawer full of unpublished manuscripts that might still see the light of day? But what does that mean that you've been writing for a long time?
So good question. So I have been on many courses. I have an unpublished novel, which is a thriller that is finished and not ready to go by any means. So that sits in a drawer. It's where I started with my journey of sending out work to a publisher. Making a Killing happened while that was out at publishers, and I finished it and probably did maybe the wrong thing, but the right thing in the end is offered it back to, in fact, it was Tequila, and I said, they already had the thriller. I said, oh, but I've got something else now. Would you like to have a look at that? And they've chosen to run with this story instead. So other unfinished manuscripts, lots. I've got lots of files on my computer of mostly thrillers, ideas for thrillers. Some of them is just literally a line or a title, ideas that have come to me. So I've probably got about 4 or 5 of those sitting. Whether they'll develop into anything, I don't know. We'll see.
And Bonnie, you've just referred to the fact that you've done writing courses. I know you've been part of writers' groups because we were in a writing group together in about 2013.
Indeed.
Yes. And I'm interested in, I don't want to put you in a position where you have to badmouth any, but I'm interested in if someone's listening and wondering what courses are useful in South Africa, what they should look for in a course, what they should look for in a group. What have you found most useful? And which method has helped you the most in learning about writing?
So writers' groups, as in a group of friends that are all writers that get together, I find those quite difficult because people are too polite. You know, there'll be a prompt. Everybody will write something for 20 minutes, 15 minutes. Everyone reads it and goes, oh, that's lovely. And you know it's not lovely. And I really get quite irritated by that because I'm really good at taking on criticism. Tell me where it's wrong, where it's not working. So I'm in a writing group here in it's not in where I live, but in Hermanus. And I urge them to be honest with me, and they're not really, I don't think. I hope they're not listening. They will listen.
They will listen.
So,
be more honest with her, guys. But, tear her apart.
Yeah. Tell me when it doesn't work. I mean, really, especially when you've got 15 minutes to write something. It's not good, and you should say so. And then I'm fairly blunt, so I'm sort of fine because they're polite. I'm obliged to be polite too, which I also don't like. I'd rather tell you where I think that went wrong. In my opinion, it's all about my own opinion, obviously. So, but courses-wise, I think for any other writer, it depends where you are at in your career. I found a lot of the, learn how to do creative writing courses extremely useful. Once I got those sort of techniques behind me and understood them, not necessarily implementing them, but knew them, can recognize them in somebody else's writing, but not necessarily being able to use them for my own writing. But now I'm under a mentorship with the All About Writing group. Okay. And that for me is the best because you buy a batch of so many thousand words and you've got to upload words, and they are harsh. Well, they're accurate. They make me laugh out loud sometimes when I realize what I've said isn't what and the confusion of understanding something and realizing it was in my head, but I didn't put it down on paper as I should have. And I can't move forward without mentorship. I really find it extremely valuable. It's month-to-month feedback. I'm looking at Gail because I know Gail shows absolutely nobody anything of what she's written. I don't know how you do that.
That sounds like a nightmare to me.
No, I don't know how you do it because I don't plot. So I go rushing along and luckily I have someone who goes, but hang on, that's not going to work because of this. And they explain why I go, oh, yeah, okay, no, I didn't really think about that. And at least I haven't finished 65,000 words before somebody told, when I discover I plotted myself into a corner. So mentoring is, for me, superb, excellent, and I really do need it. It's guidance. It's somebody holding my hand.
Tell us about leaving Joburg and moving to a small town. What was that experience really like in real life? And what do the movies and books get wrong about that? Because there's always this hallmark idea of sort of moving to a small town and starting a bakery that you've inherited from your long-lost relative, et cetera, et cetera, meeting the handsome guy. I'm really leaning into the hallmark.
You're starting a plot. Yeah.
But what's it really like? What is it really like adjusting from city life to small town life? How is it different?
I've embraced every minute of it. I don't think it is for everyone. I sold a large-ish house in Johannesburg, put three dogs in a motor car and drove down to a village I knew no one. I met people really quickly because it's a very dog-friendly village. So when you go out with the dogs every morning, in no time at all, you know all the dogs' names, you know no humans' names, but you know the dogs. So I was able to meet people quite quickly. I built a house here, so I started afresh from that point of view. I love it. It's a sense of community. I lived in a house in Johannesburg for 17 years. I'd never met the neighbors. Here, I know not everyone, but a large proportion of people. It's a huge community value. And I think that's not for everyone because they are very nosy. Mm-hmm. They do know if you go out, I saw there was you had a friend stay over last night. Oh, yeah. You know, they know everything. But it's part of the charm about it all. I'm sounding lyrical here in that I just love small village life. I don't have a shop. There's a little grocery shop, tiny one. There's no, people want to go shopping. There's no shopping in where I live. It's just there is nothing. People eat and have dinners much more frequently because there's only a handful of restaurants. So it's, what can I say? It was the best move I ever made. My sister only after, it was about 2 years ago, actually said to me, they, as a family, gave me 2 years because I'd moved from a big job, traveling internationally 4, 5, 6 times a year. My running career was important to me. I used to raise guard dog puppies. Mm. There was a huge part of my life. Gay will remember her children playing with some of the puppies I had. So I left all of that behind to this tiny village. And my sister, 2 years, she won't last. She'll never make it. And I've been here almost 8 now. And in fact, August is 8 years. And I love it.
You're making me want to pack up my goods and go immediately. Now, obviously, living in a small village has had an effect on your writing. We can see that in Making a Killing.
Yes.
How does the village feel about having a resident writer who is writing about a small village?
They have embraced it. They've all been, I've had huge support. I had an interesting thing happen in that there were three authors all published books in the same month here in our small village. I'm not sure whether to say the small village, but it's Stanford in the Western Cape. Mine's the only fiction one, though. Yeah. So the other two are memoirs, so very, very different to what I've written. I loved it. I had a message from somebody in the village about a week ago saying, "Well done, Bonnie, you nailed it." And I know exactly who all the people are. And I was like, "Well, do you? Because I don't. Because I've worked really, really hard at not using one person. And of course, there are characters in my head that I've based on some of the locals, but not only these locals. We've all got experiences where, so they're all a mixture of different people. I've made sure that the names don't sound the same. I have a Constable Moritz in my book, but he originally was Constable Meyerberg, And we don't have a Constable Meiberg, but we do have somebody with a surname Meiberg. So I made sure I changed that to Maritz so that Meiberg doesn't think that constable's got anything to do with them. You know, it's so I worked really hard at making sure nothing was tangible. There are incidents in the book, though, the flood, that the villagers will recognize. I also have made fictitious street names, but one or two are accurate. King Street, well, I think every small village has got a King Street. So, yeah. But yes, the village gave me the ideas. Living in a small village gave me the ideas.
Let's talk about genre for a moment, because Making a Killing is a very, very interesting book. I've seen it described as cozy crime, and the cover makes it look like cozy crime. But I would argue that you, Bonnie, are more Quentin Tarantino than Katie Gale, for example. it's a genre-defying book. How did that come about? Yeah. Were you consciously breaking the rules of the genre, or was the sort of coziness retro-engineered by the publishers? How did that all happen?
It's an interesting story. I had finished the book, and I had two protagonists. One was Winifred, as you know, and the other one was Maud.
Oh.
And I sent it out piecemeal to somebody to read once it was finished, and they hadn't got to some of the bits, and they said to me, "This is English. It should be set in the UK. It's cozy crime." And I want to say, well, it's not going to be so cozy. But they were determined that I should be setting this book in a small village in England. Mm-hmm. And I went, no, it's South African. What's wrong with them? Can't they see it's South African? So that's when I changed Maud to Sylvie and made it more South African, brought in a bit of the Afrikaans Cape lingo to bed it more strongly into a South African scene. And that's also when it took more of a darker turn, because Sylvie, that protagonist, made herself known to me. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I could do more fun things. Winifred and Maud were both fairly upright, can I use the word white, older ladies, you know, with that sort of feeling. But once Sylvie entered the picture, she brought more fun and it got turned a bit darker. And I think subconsciously I didn't want it to be cozy crime. I never set out to write cozy crime. I set out to write a story about a village. Mm-hmm. That's where it started for me. It wasn't cozy crime. I didn't think of any genre when I started. It was just two women who run a bookshop in a small village. That's where it started.
I'm very interested in this. So that version that had Maud in it, was that, okay, we can't spoil this book because there is a big twist. But that big twist, was that in the version with Maud? How much did you rewrite when Sylvie came onto the scene? Did that whole genre-defying twist only come along with Sylvie?
Yeah, you ask me this question, I actually can't tell you how it did end, but it was finished. I'd already sent it to Quella. I'm trying to think along the line. The twist was already there, but then I made it more South African.
Okay.
So I think that was the key. So no, the twist was already there.
Okay.
The twist was already there, but the very, 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 very last twist, the genre bending was already there.
Okay.
But the very, very last twist or the last couple of pages, that wasn't there. That was once, I love your publishers. I already had a contract in my hands when they said they didn't like the ending. And I went, oh, what? Because I dug deep to write the ending as it was. And I was given a deadline of 6 weeks to change the ending. And that's when that last twist happened. I've discovered I'm really good under pressure. Give me 6 weeks that it wasn't only the ending. Of course, it was a bit in the middle they didn't like, and of course, it was a little bit in the beginning they didn't like. So I had three major slots to tweak and polish and whatever. But it was the ending that gave me the angst. And together with a local friend, I went, I don't know. I've done my best on the ending. I have no idea how to change it. And kudos to her. She came up with that idea. And then when I told her I'd used it, she said, no, you can't use that. You know, it was a joke in her eyes. So the genre bending was already there in the first version. The second version was more local flavor, more local dialogue. And the very last twist came as a request from the publisher. You know how they phrase it. You don't have to change it, but we would like you to have a look at a different ending. And that's when I delivered that last ending. Thanks to the deadline. If I'd been given more time, I don't know if I would have got that.
That's interesting.
And do you know if the publishers kind of scratched their heads a bit about how to pitch this, how to market it, whether to pitch it as cozy crime, and also how you were required to talk about it on panels and so forth, whether to lean more into the coziness or more into the kind of caper angle of it? Were those discussions that were happening?
We had one very early discussion before a contract was ever on the table. And the question was posed, it sort of presents as cozy crime. And then it was an open-ended question. And I said, it's not cozy crime. No, we know that. So, you know, and I said, if you want cozy crime, I could possibly try and write something totally different, not this book. And that's all. That's the only discussion we've ever had. When we got the cover, I have to be honest, I did not love the cover. I argued endlessly about the cover because it was more embellished than it is now. Anyhow, long and short of it, I was wrong and they were right. The cover has been a hit, a huge hit, and I was totally wrong. And I'm glad I didn't get my way. I was able to put a few little elements in, which, you know, the little vine with a skull or two on top of it. So they also did want to not make it 100% cozy because they didn't need somebody buying it as cozy and getting a bit of a fright halfway through. I think that was the reason they liked this. It was that genre bending. It was a risk. Mm-hmm. I understand the risk they took in accepting this for publication. I think Quella were brave in their decision. I was nervous, I'll be honest about it, because I knew it was, you know, wasn't exactly normal. But it's worked, I think. I think it's worked. Yeah.
I think it's worked. I'm interested, you've spoken about that you would like it if writing groups were more critical, and then you've spoken about the notes you get on editing, which are critical. We all know they are critical. How have you found that editing process? Did you enjoy that high level of fix this end, fix this middle, fix this character? Did it work for you?
I did. Yes, I liked it. 100% right. The old ending was not nice, wasn't good, wasn't perfect. And wow, look what happened when I was told you got to fix it. And I'm really grateful for that, very grateful for that. You know, the middle, there was a change in the middle too. And both of those were key points where I struggled. You realize it's where you were struggling and you sort of put down something that was good enough, but not its best. And they did identify those. They were 100% right. And I was really pleased that that book, that first book, that what I thought was my finished version, didn't get printed. I'm pleased. It saved me. It saved me from putting out a book that could have been better. And this is better. It's not best, but it's better, definitely, for that feedback, 100%. Yeah, bring it on. If a reader or a person who reads it criticizes something, they haven't understood it. That's their perception of it, which means I haven't done it right. I've left something unsaid that you don't understand what I was trying to say. I think that's valuable.
Now, Bonnie, you wrote to our podcast and asked us about writing about characters from a different cultural background to yourself. specifically yes. as a white woman writing characters of color. And I think we gave you our sort of standard answer, which is, you know, it's something we are still wrestling with, but, you know, take these various things into consideration. So having done it now, and Sylvie is a woman of color with a different background to yours, and I feel as though she's really well written, beautifully fleshed out. What is your best advice now to other authors? What have you learned from the process, and what could you pass on to other authors?
So the way I finally approached it was that urgency of making it more South African, which is why I chose that. The fact that Sylvie is of another race, I don't punt it. It's a very subtle thing I say. I think some readers might even read over it. I think the one reference is she's from the Ornador, and that's all I say, because that doesn't matter. Sylvie's Sylvie. That's actually all that matters. Where I don't go, because I really am not equipped to go there, is any, you know, South Africa's past or anything like that. Sylvie becomes for me in my writing just most another character, because that is what she is. She's not necessarily anything else other than that. So I would never tackle anything of any sensitive nature. I'm not equipped to do that. I don't want to do that. I just love Sylvie. I mean, Sylvie's such fun. And she became fun because of the ability to put a bit of Afrikaans into it, a sort of Cape, Kaapse Afrikaans into it. That's where the fun came. So I hope I've done her well and sensitively, but I don't think I've stood on any toes. I'm not a political person. I'm not a person who follows history or the news too closely, so I will never try and do that.
Bonnie, I'm very interested in writing the second book in a series, and particularly when you've done the genre-bending thing that everyone needs to go and read the book so they understand what we're talking about. How has that been? How is it feeling?
So when I started writing it as just a story in a small village with two ladies who own a bookshop, the mentors that I'm under kept saying, you do realize this is a series. And I said, no, it's not. It's not a series. No, it is a series. No, it's not a series. I'm not writing a series. So I was adamant it wasn't a series. And it wasn't a series when I sent it in for publication, for consideration for publication. And then that new ending came. Then it became a series. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, I didn't plan this at all. So, yeah, now suddenly I have a sequel I have to write. I am writing. And the sequel, I don't plan. So the idea for the ending for the book two will lead to a third book. And then I think it's finished. It's a three book thing in my head at this stage. But anything could happen. I haven't finished it, so I don't know what's going to happen in the end yet. When I get there, I'll know.
That's very interesting. I don't know if I've been influenced by this, the publisher calling it a cozy mystery, that I've been seeing it as the beginning of a 10-book series. Does that give you the heebie-jeebies?
It gives me the heebie-jeebies. Absolute heebie-jeebies, yeah. I have a slight idea for book three, but... No, it was never going to be a series, not at all.
Tell us about your short fiction, the story that you contributed to the collection In Other Stories, which I think you mentioned was a Kerry Hamilton initiative. Is yes. that in the same sort of vein as Making a Killing, or is it something completely different?
No, it's very similar. It's fairly brutal. Quick, sharp, and yeah. It's about a dinner party. It's less than 500 words about a dinner party.
So you can't tell us much without spoiling.
No, it's only 500 words, so I can't tell you more. So no.
And Bonnie, is writing short fiction something you've done a lot of, or did you do it for this project as a new experiment?
So the group that I'm with, All About Writing, they used to do I think every 2 months, they used to have a prompt, and it was 250 words, if I remember correctly. And I I never used to enter all of them, but if I read that prompt and I get an idea, I write it. You know, I do it straight away. So if I read the prompt and nothing comes in, I drop it. And I like it. It's a form I quite enjoy, that very short, 250 words, get a story across. I think I've won one of these. I did. I won a course or something for that. One of them that I did for that. So I like that. Funny enough, short stories, as in 3,000 words to 5,000 words, I can't do.
Okay.
It's sort of like I just get going. It's like being on a bicycle. You know, you just get into a momentum and you've got to finish. So I can't do those. I've tried. I've tried to enter short story competitions and I've not been successful. But the very short flash, I quite love. I like the challenge of getting in quick at the, I think it was something I listened to on your last podcast. It was an old one I listened to the other day. I think it was Pamela Power's one. Mm-hmm. Basically, get in when you're almost finished. You know, that I like that.
Yeah.
Into the action, out the action, all in 250 words.
Nice.
I enjoy that.
So I'm so interested to hear that this short piece of yours is in a similar vein to Making a Killing. And I have to ask, and I'm sure you've been asked this before, where does this darkness come from inside Bonnie? Because
it doesn't go very well with guide dog puppies.
Yes, you definitely have a dark side. And where does it come from? And are you getting some side eye from the neighbors?
I don't know where it comes from, other than my mother read crime. So I think it's just I was led into the crime genre. So I think that's what it is. I don't really know. I'm not dark, by the way. I'm really quite nice. I'm not. I'm fairly blunt and brutal, but forthright is how I put myself. But I haven't killed anyone or, you know.
Yet.
Yeah.
I was expecting the word
yet. Yet.
Bonnie, in many ways, it looks from the outside looking in that what has happened to you over the last few months is a bit like the dream, that where the book really takes off. And, you know, every time I open the Good Book Appreciation Society, there's another person reviewing it. It's everywhere at the moment. How much is it feeling to you like that dream?
It's exactly that. It's unbelievable. It's been overwhelming, the success of it. And I say success, I don't know. I'm nervous to ask about numbers. I have asked about numbers and you get the standard thing as so many books have been out. But, you know, they can come back. They could sit on the shelf for 6 months and all get sent back in, you know, by December or whatever. But I've had very good feedback. I've had lots and lots of private messages come through saying, wow, loved it. Can't wait for the sequel. So it's been a bit of a surprise, especially as I didn't intend any of it, meaning I didn't sit down to write cozy crime, I didn't set out to write a genre-bending story. You know, there's no sort of plan about this. I just wrote a book about a village. When I changed it to the South African version of it, I thought it was better than the first, and I thought, oh, well, let's send this in, let's see what happens, you know. I thought my career would go down the road of thrillers, not of this. This was spawned by the village, without a doubt. Watching the characters in the village, there's so much stuff. I'm never short of material. So, no, it has been a surprise, a big surprise. But I have to say, I've been writing for many years, and finally it's happened. So it might seem a dream to a lot of people, but it's been a lot of background working, trying, writing, you know. So it hasn't been an immediate success.
And I've got a follow-on question to that, which you've actually led into. How much do you think it is? Because as you've been writing over these years, you've been going to the writers' groups, you've been going to launches, you've met people in the writing community. Do you think that has helped with what feels like the overnight success? Or do you think that hasn't really been relevant to it?
No, it's helped. I think the writing community has been fabulous. They've embraced a new person on their turf. We all know as writers, the market is small. You know, if somebody's buying my book this month, might mean they're not buying your book this month. And yet I've been very warmly welcomed into the fold. So no, it's been fabulous. I'm grateful for all the support I've received from everyone in the industry, you know, whether it's writers, editors, everybody. It's been fabulous.
So we don't really think that it means that if they bought your book, they're not buying that other person's book. We think that it means if they love your book, they go, oh, actually, South African writers are great. Let me buy another South African writer.
Somewhere I've had that. Was it on one of the posts I've had somebody say, I'm going to now start reading more South African writers. Mm. So because I'm now meeting more and more and more local authors, I'm on panels. I'm trying to, my reading right now is dictated by who I'm meeting, because I want to be able to read their book before I sit on a panel with them. And it's wonderful. Again, I've always read South African authors, so it's not new to me. I've always had an interest in South African writers. But now I'm earnestly trying to, you know, my reading pile is made up of local authors that I've heard about, that I know are good, that I'm going to potentially meet, and I want to read their books.
You talked about that the novel came out of the village. So obviously when one sets a story in a village, you can't just have your main character or your two main characters. You've got to flesh it out with all these other characters, people who are living there, some of whom might make it to the end of the book and some of whom might not. but how would you advise authors who are setting a book in a village scenario? How much do you try and fill out the population of that village? If you mention someone, and then you mention them again 50 pages later, do you need to reintroduce them to the reader? How do you handle that kind of thing?
So I have found that quite difficult. One of the bits of advice from the publisher too was there were too many names. Mm-hmm. So I lost one or two characters, amalgamated one or two, and drop some of the names. The names are people that are just arbitrary people who are there for whatever reason I've dropped. One fun thing that came out of that, although, is I spoke to a bookstore owner who's read the book and said to me, please tell me Constable Moritz is in book two. And I was like, what? Really? You know, because Constable Moritz had slipped out of my head. But she loved him. And if you read the book, you know why she loved him. I thought, I've got to put him back. So he's back. So that's one character that was, I was not going to take forward with me to book two, but he's there. You'll see Constable Moritz in his undies again. So,
Bonnie, I have become very interested in not where do you get your ideas or how do you get your ideas, because we know that I hate that question, but when do you get your ideas? When is it that an idea will come to you? And I'm wondering for you, is it when you're running?
I don't run anymore. My friend is right. What will you do when you're old and you can't run anymore? Yeah, no, I don't run anymore. So, no, ideas come to me all the time. Just snippets of stuff. I can't tell you. You know, it might be a movie I watch or a book I read or I don't know. Is the answer. I just have an idea and I think I must remember that, and then I'll open a file and I'll give it a name, a title that will remind me of the idea.
And does that work? Do you remember?
I do, yes. If they're good enough. So like everyone else, I have an idea and I think I must remember that, but I'm busy doing something else. And then an hour later, I think, damn, what was that? And it's gone. But if it's good enough, it seems to stay. It comes back to me. And book two, the idea came from an Instagram post that I saw of somebody's vineyard. I went, oh my goodness, look at that photograph, because it's a stunning photograph. And that spawned the idea for book two. So that's, you know,
that's
I don't know what book three's theme will be yet. But something will come to me and I'll know that that's book three. I haven't got it yet.
That's a writer that you see a beautiful photo of a vineyard and you think, I'm going to kill someone there.
I wanted to ask about the character of Winifred and how much of yourself you put into her, because I could see some parallels, but also you made her extremely tall and you are not. and she's very kind of haunted by her Catholic background. It's very much a presence in her life. So I'm just interested, obviously not literally you, but how much of yourself did you put into that character?
I think if there is a character in the book that is me, it would be her. Yes, Winifred. She's pretty buttoned up and disciplined. I'm pretty disciplined. You know, I've run a business. I've run many long marathons. You've got to be disciplined, get out of bed and do the work. I didn't run away from Joburg like Winnie does, but yeah, I see she likes to do things right and proper like, so as opposed to Sylvie, who will bend rules. So she is a bit of me. She likes to read.
And related to that in a way, I suppose not in a way, writing male characters. I have a lot of fun writing bad men, and I've wondered, I have asked you this in another place, but how you feel about, did you have fun with that?
I did, yes. I seem to have material about bad men, so yes, I do enjoy writing them.
And Bonnie, we want to ask you finally, obviously you did start reading at some point in your life because you didn't carry on with your childhood habit of firmly not reading. But what have you been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression on you?
So I've just done three, I think, Nikki French books. I really like Nikki French. I think the first Nikki French I ever read years and years and years ago was The Silent Smile, I think it was called. It's cracker. I mean, it's just so good. So I've just finished her book called Unheard, which is about a young child who sees things and nobody believes the mother knows something's wrong with the child. I think she's four. I've just done The Four Elements from John Boyne. Mm-hmm. Very glad that I read 1, 2, 3, 4 all in a row and not as they were published, because the links between them are fairly subtle, and I think I might have forgotten if I'd read them individually, you know, 6 months apart or whatever they were. I'm not quite sure what the publishing timeline was for them. So, I mean, he's a fabulous writer. What else have I just finished? I've just finished Marina Ora's book, Three Echoes, which is a thriller, a very fast-moving thriller. I've enjoyed that. Next on my list is, because I'm going to be on a panel with her, is Unsolicited by, I think it's Andrea Shaw. So it's also a local crime detective novel, which I need to read. Well, I want to read, not I need to read.
Need and want can live together.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Bonnie, we hope everyone checks out Making a Killing, which is on all bookshelves right now. It's published by Quella Books. We are both very much looking forward to the sequel. Mm-hmm. We hope it'll be out soon, and everyone should look out for that. So thank you, Bonnie. This has been great. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's been fabulous. Thank you.
Gail, I had not properly met Bonnie before that interview, but you had. You've been in a writing group with her. You've interviewed her for Kingsmead. But I feel as though you probably still got a lot out of that.
I absolutely did. I found it so interesting. And I think the thing I find most interesting about Bonnie is that she didn't give up. She said, this isn't an overnight event. You know, I've tried and tried and tried. And I really am interested by that and inspired by that. So I was very interested in what she said about that when you write that bit that is good enough but is not your best writing, it will be picked up. Mm. It will show. Mm. And I think maybe it comes back to what I was saying last week about reading through my book and going, what did I enjoy? What did I not enjoy? Mm-hmm. And I think we probably would find that the bits I didn't enjoy were where I wasn't showing up properly. I was doing something for the sake of getting the words down and not really thinking properly about where the story was going, how it worked. And sometimes you have to do that. Like sometimes you really, the only way you'll keep the momentum going is to try and to write crap and hope for the best. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But it resonated with me. I think that that's exactly what I was picking up doing that exercise.
Yes. And, you know, I always secretly hope that the part that I know is the weakest is actually really good. And that the editor's going to come back and say, you know, I love that part. It's the best part of the whole book. And they never, ever do.
They never do.
If you know it's the weakest part, it is the weakest part. Yeah.
I think that's the truth.
And the truth will come to light, unfortunately.
Well, that's a bit depressing. I really hope my 500 words today aren't bad ones. What did you take from it, Fiona?
I took a lesson in the value of writing courses.
Mm.
And it's something that I resisted as a young writer. I really thought, you know, my natural brilliance will shine through and somehow I'll eventually get published. And I did. But it took years and years and years of trying and failing and not knowing exactly why I had failed. And I know that if I'd been part of a writing course or if I'd just taken some lessons in how to write fiction, I would have succeeded at a younger age.
Mm.
And it's such important advice to me. If you are starting out at whatever age, do a writing course, do more than one writing course, get some feedback. Find out what you're doing wrong, and then maybe you will have what seems like an overnight success, as Bonnie has had.
And read the books about writing, I'd add into that. You know, learn everything you can. I always think if from every course you do and every book on writing you read, even if you only take one thing that rings true to you and is real for you and is useful to you, that's a thing you didn't have in your toolbox before.
Yes.
And yeah, I would agree. I'm exactly the same as you. I just jumped into it. And also I think I could have been further, faster, better if I had done courses.
Yeah. Yeah. So if any of our listeners have done a writing course or been part of a writer's group, if that's worked for you, we'd like to hear about it. We'd like to know what in particular has worked for you. So please get in touch. We're on all social media across the board and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.